night. And the thing I need to tell you about Jim is not only has he been a practicing therapist for 25 years plus. Okay. You say 30. Jim has an artistic bent. And his whole family has an artistic bent. And if you go to the Dallas Art Review, you can see, or he has actually has his own website. He's a writer, okay, and he's an actor. And I think some of your family members are visual artists. Yep, some of the visual art. So tonight, Jim is going to, I think, talk to us something about long-term relationships. And we'll just, Jim, you run the presentation or the meeting any way you see fit.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm glad to see my fame obviously preceded me, and that's why the crowd tonight. I'm a Dallas native. I grew up in Oak Cliff, Texas. I still live in Oak Cliff, Texas. I went to the University of Dallas, graduated from UD in 1975 in psychology with a minor in philosophy. I went to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh because I was so enamored of my teachers at UD that I thought that Duquesne would be a great place to go. I went there and got a master's degree in clinical psychology. I noticed that there were a lot of people getting very, very old trying to finish their PhDs there. And there, I remember there was one gentleman who could not get his proposal accepted year after year after year because the committee kept saying that his phenomenon wasn't really a phenomenon. And I thought that sounds like it could be really bad for me because I didn't want to get really old before I did PhD. So I left Duquesne, came back to Dallas, started working in public mental health, went into private practice starting in 78, went into private practice in 83. Ever since, I have been doing a lot of individual and marital psychotherapy. Most people who do what I do, about a third of what they do, maybe even a half for some, is going to be working with relationships. So you get exposed to enough of this stuff and you stay married long enough, there are certain things that you learn that seem to be over and over again true of every relationship that walks in the door, including the relationship that you live in. So I began to kind of notice that over the years, I found myself saying the same things over and over again to people who were in treatment with me for a relationship problem. And I began to kind of collate these and write them down. And they became as kind of a set of aphorisms, queries, statements, remarks, observations that I like to share with people. I hope that what we're going to do tonight is have more of a conversation than me standing here and talking to you for 30 or 45 minutes. So I want you to know from the beginning that you're free to interrupt, add to, take away, modify, question, tell me I'm wrong. I don't care if I'm wrong. I mean, I'm not here to be right or wrong. I'm here to kind of stimulate some thinking about something that's very obvious and very common and very omnipresent in our world, the long-term committed relationship, also known as marriage. I mean, everybody has at least been in one or is in one. And there is tons of advice available about how to do it, and how to do it good, and how to make it better, and how to solve problems, and how to have better sex. But no one thinks to me that I've yet to come across anything that is more of an objective querying of what is this thing that we call marriage. So, I'm going to make my statement. Now, I entitled this talk Towards an Existential Phenomenology. Well, now that's hanging some pretty fancy clothes on what I'm going to say tonight. But, I figure you see it's a philosopher's forum. I'm going to toss out some stuff about marriage. see what you guys think about it. So we're going to call it Towards an Existential Phenomenology. All right. I was trained and educated in existentialism and phenomenology in college. Let's remember that existentialism is that way of thinking that asks us to understand that there is no transcendent reality that ultimately justifies what we do here on Earth. That we give meaning to whatever it is we do. Oddly enough, this is exactly what the Zen people say in Zen. They call this thing that is before you, that is the entirety of creation, they call that Mu. What is Mu? Mu is this right now, and it is the entirety of all that is for you and for no one else. So, you know, it's interesting for me to see that. I call this phenomenology because phenomenology is the study of experience. What is it like? What is it like? What is the experience of being married? Not what should it be. Not what does the romantic myth say it is, but what is it really? And as we all know, what it really is a struggle. But let's be honest about that. Let's not take away from it. Let's not diminish it. Let's not run it down. But let's to be truthful about it. It is a struggle. And it's a very, very worthwhile struggle. It's a struggle that's worth having. Sisyphus had his struggle. Sisyphus got in trouble with Zeus. Does anybody remember what Sisyphus did? He pulled some kind of a scam on Zeus. Tell me.
No, I'm not sure
it
was Zeus. I thought it was
the
god of the underworld.
Oh, that's right. It was
Hades. Right.
Yeah.
Well, Hades went to the underworld and tried to defeat Hades' principle of that he was captured there. So he was in his throne, was up and down, and the great hurt.
Sisyphus was also a mortal farmer, and he was invading the mountains of the gods, right? And he got slapped down for overstepping his position. Very common theme in Greek mythology, in Greek philosophy, you know, the sin of hubris, overstepping your own position in life. But Sisyphus got thrown into Hades and told that his job throughout eternity would be to roll this rock. Sisyphus eventually made his peace with the rock. It's not, you know, we talked about it, you know, it's when we first come across the myth of Sisyphus, it always speaks to us as this humongously meaningless, onerous, terrible task to roll that rock up the hill every day. And yet it speaks to us so loudly and potently, so clearly. Because in so many ways, that's exactly what our human lives are all about. To do the same thing in the same way, day in and day out, and to somehow find a way to extract meaning from that experience, as in Sisyphus. So I think of the long-term committed relationship as being a Sisyphusian task, of devoting ourselves completely to the task of being in this relationship, being who and what I am to that other person, while that other person does exactly the same thing with me. And out of that dialogue comes this third thing that we call the relationship that takes on a life of its own, which we ultimately suffer with and rejoice in. And sometimes suffer and rejoice at the same time. At the same time. The young person who is newly married always, always thinks that they've got it figured out. They're not going to make the same mistakes that have been made before them. I have picked the right person. This is going to be a good marriage. This is going to be a good relationship. This isn't going to be like mom and dad's, or the people across the street, or my neighbors that are always fighting. This marriage is going to be a really good one. And then, slowly but surely over time, there emerges this third entity, this unwieldy thing that they cannot get control of, that no one person has control of. No one. I don't have control of it, you don't have control of it. But somehow, in some kind of way, something snatches us both, and we both become miserable, and we fight. Or something snatches us both, and we have great, great sex. Or something grabs hold of us both, and we have the time, the unbelievable time of our lives, riding the roller coaster, or looking at the cliffs in Northern California. And no one person is responsible for that. It's that third thing that comes out of you and I. Again, you and I is something that was spoken of a lot in existential as well. But we won't elaborate that anymore. So, with that said, I will set before you my random, orderless, and scattered observations regarding relationships. And we're going to start with this first one. All relationships are screwed up. Not some, but all. And why is that? Because they're composed of human beings. Human beings trying to reinvent the wheel, trying to reinvent how to go forward with this collision of universes. I always think of marriage as this massive. You ever seen those deep space photographs that show these two huge star clusters, billions of stars colliding with one another? That's what marriage is. Marriage is this epic collision of two universes coming closer and closer and closer and closer and closer. And as they do, there is this friction, this inevitable friction that causes power struggles and misery and misunderstanding and difficulty and pleasure and sadness and divorce and violence. Emotional violence, physical violence, verbal violence. Who hasn't called their husband or wife a bad name? Right? That's violence. All relationships are screwed up. And what does this mean? Okay, if you make a move decision to not commit suicide or to not end the relationship and decide to go on with the relationship, it implies certain things that you're obliged to do. One of the things that you're obliged to do is, as a member of that screwed up relationship, your lifelong task is to work at unscrewing the relationship. Whether the other person is doing the same thing or not at exactly the same time as you. And that's a problem for most of us, because the child in us wants to go, but she's not doing anything, or he's not picking up, or, you know, whatever that might be. But it requires, if you have intended, if you have said to yourself, I want this relationship to work, then there are certain things you have to do. You have to work at unscrewing the relationship in your own way, as best you can. What does that usually mean? I think that over the long haul, what it really means is being who you are. Being clear with yourself and the other person as best you possibly can, who and what you are. And that's a process that takes time. No one knows how to completely expose their own soul to another person when they're 24. When you're 24, you're not in the business of exposing your soul to others. You're in the business of exposing just how awesome you are. Right? Just how fantastic you really are when you're 24. Any comments? Queries? Yes.
All I was going to say, it's obvious that lifetime monogamy is anthropologically an anomaly. It doesn't, of the 3,000 cultures that we've studied, less than 5% of us do it. And in human history, it's very unusual behavior, looking at 99.5% of our existence, being hunter-gatherers who practice serial monogamy, and pretty much like people in L.A. do it, changing partners every 7 years. So aren't you, when you're trying to do something that goes against what's DNA, what's built into your DNA, you've always been going to prompt. And I think you've assessed it correctly that lifetime monogamy is a pathology. It's not something that we're capable of doing comfortably.
I think of it as the intrusion of consciousness into instinct.
Well, it's
consciousness can create these rules.
In an article I was reading about the invention of lifetime monogamy, it was becoming an economic necessity only because of the invention of the plow. And of the 3,000 cultures they've studied, the only ones that have it are the ones that actually use the plow. It went on to describe how the plow made it an economic necessity. But it's in the agrarian culture that we live in, you know, it's based on, you know, the God of grapes and wheat. It's the accepted norm, but in our DNA, it's so abnormal for us to try to do that sort of thing.
Now, there was someone who had reacted rather
strongly. These are moments before, as well. He's been coming here for a long time.
You want to say something?
Me?
Yes. You said a lot.
You just said a lot.
No, I can't hear you.
You can't hear me?
No, I can't hear you.
Oh. All relationships, this is a corollary, all relationships are messes. In other words, they're unwieldy. They are disorganized. They are never the same thing 2 days in a row. And there are people who want to devote themselves to cleaning up the mess, to getting it organized, to getting everything in its right compartment, to doing things that are normal. Let's have a normal relationship. Usually that person who wants to have a normal relationship is attracted to and usually tries to bond with people who have absolutely no interest whatever in a normal relationship. So what I've learned over the years is that if your intention is to make these things last, what has to be done is that there has to be a succumbing to the mess. I call it dropping into the mess, letting it completely cover you with its messiness. Reach out to that partner, grab hold, and form a partnership with that person that says, let's you and I together see if we can't figure out a way to straighten this thing up. To live with this mess, live in this mess, clean up this mess, tolerate this mess, make it a better mess, make it a worse mess, but somehow, because you and I together, do something about this mess. Now, what that means is that until we finally discover that our only ally in the problem of the relationship is the partner, what happens in the meantime? Power struggle. Lots and lots of power struggle. You always do this, you never do that. Why do you have to do X, Y, or Z? Why do we have to do this, that, and the other thing? Who says that you're in charge of the money? Who says that you're in charge of the household? Who says that you get to pick what? Finally, what you learn is if you're going to learn anything at all, is that your ally in that struggle is sitting right there arguing with you, disagreeing with you. And it really works, if the other person has a similar discovery at about the same time. Now, I couch all of this in terms of if you want the relationship to go forward. I'm not here to tell you how to make it better or how to, I'm not Dr. Phil giving relationship tips or how to improve things. This is all covered under the heading of if you want it to survive, if you want it to be a place that is workable and livable for you. That's it. Okay. Moving along. Yes?
Just aside from, side benefits like sex or financial support or things like that, why do you think so many people do want relationships? What do you think people are seeking?
Yeah, that's a good question. What do you think?
Well, I think since you asked, I don't know what you
think. They're a therapist. I would get you to answer first.
No, I think it's the flip side of what you said about achieving success being letting your authentic self show through. I think what we seek out of relationships is that which shows us our authentic self.
Oh, very good. I like that. And we seek, and I actually kind of mentioned that later on, but we seek the relationship in order to be who we really are. And we can't really discover who or what that is until we have that mirror that can give us back. Give feedback. I like that. It's very good. And if you're not appealing to anthropology, you're good. We cannot go back in our relationships. A lot of times when people find themselves in a terrible struggle and are uncertain about how to go forward, one of the things that we do is we go back and start thinking, well, when was it good when we first got married? Why can't we be like it was when we first got married? Or when we were in our first house, or when the first child was born, or whatever. We always want to go back, and we have to understand that there is no going back. Evolution only goes in one direction. It goes into the future. The purpose of commitment to the other person and to the relationship is to be free. And this kind of goes to what Mark was talking about. To be free to be who and what I am. And to share that with the other. In other words, we both enter into this contract to be who and what we are, to pursue our individual freedom. Does that mean to be impulsive or to act out, as we say in psychology? No, it means to be free to bring your true self into the world and to do everything that you possibly can to engage that with the world. What I owe my partner is the results of my own exploration of my destiny. To me, destiny and the true self are interchangeable. To say one is to say the other. So I don't use it in terms of that thing out there towards which we tend, which is what destiny means. But what it actually, what I mean is, when I say destiny, is this true self. To enact all of who and what I am and bring it into this world. Yes.
I differ with that. I think the real problem is self-centeredness. You've got a relationship. You're trying to build a family or you're trying to build a business. Those will get all concerned with their own immature selves. That's where you get screwed up. Concentrate on the brother, the man, whatever the honor is, whatever the duty and responsibilities are, concentrate on those. And you forget the self. I think once you totally forget the self, then you're not going to have any kind of this hovering around trying to figure out what the self wants.
Okay. Everybody here to comment?
Could you speak louder, please?
Yeah.
A few successful marriages that I've personally known of have been people where both halves seem to go more than 50-50.
Yeah.
They didn't try quite the same. They did the job. And they went way over serving the other more than you expected. The opposite.
So his comment is that the successful long-term relationship is where each side comes to the understanding that the best way to go forward is to be of service to the other side, to the other person.
I'm hearing a subtext from both of those comments. It seems to be saying that there's sacrifice involved in being of self-centeredness. And that may or may not be true. For me, to be whatever I want to be in my life, to be what she wants to be in her relationship in the world, may not necessarily mean we use some hurt ourselves. And I think that sometimes when we approach it, we with this false premise, this premise from the beginning that it's going involved. And it may not necessarily have that. It may not necessarily have that. Not everything is going to be in conflict with that.
Yeah, I think this gentleman's observation had to do with the fact that if I understand bringing my true self into the world as being graining the child in me or the inauthentic self in me or the ego in me, its whims and fancies and impulses, then that's going to create problems, which of course it does. And we can all think back to early in marriage and remember those times when you were doing that as well. I can remember when I was doing that, where it was much more important to me to do something that was social or something that was fun or something that I thought would aggrandize me rather than to pay attention to the real obligations I had created for myself at home. But I think that for what my proposal is that the authentic self is something that slowly emerges over time. It's not fully formed, nor is it ever fully formed, I don't believe. It's always in process.
But it does not emerge early in marriage. It emerges later on. But it starts early on with those youthful projects of, I want to be this, or I want to be that, or I want to try, I want to make this, or I want to be an astronaut, or a fireman, or a psychotherapist, or whatever. And that comes out slowly over time. And the place within which to do that is, of course, in the long-term committed relationship that we've created, and which is a mess, and which I am slowly but surely working at cleaning up or making it a tolerable mess. Yes?
Jim, I read this book by Christopher Lash called The Culture of Narcissism. I think the book was written around 1980.
Yeah.
And I'm just kind of curious, because you've been practicing since around that time. I mean, if you've seen people that you're seeing become more narcissistic, especially in the younger generation, because of the kinds of activities that they participate in now and what they're doing, as opposed to more social
issues. Well, you know, first off, you know, narcissism is a word that gets thrown around a lot. You know, and also is, in the present moment, one of the worst things that you can call someone is a narcissist. You know, if you really want to, you know, you call them a narcissist and you're in, you know, you've delivered a knockout blow there. But let's remember that the narcissist, the clinical definition of the narcissist is the person whose vision or picture of himself or herself is so deeply flawed that they have completely engaged themselves in the creation of this external facade that they ask everyone to relate to. And it's kind of like, you know, the funny little man in the booth in The Wizard of Oz. You know, pay no attention to the funny little man in the booth. Look at the Great Oz. And we have to understand that the true narcissist is a person who is deeply troubled, suffers intensely, day in and day out, and does not live a happy life. And so, you know, to live in this narcissistic culture, I don't know. I mean, you know, you can remember in the 80s, the 80s was all about surfaces, entirely about gorgeous, glimmering, slick, shiny surfaces, whether it's music or video or whatever form of culture we're talking about. So, you know, you can say that 80s culture was narcissistic. You can say that American culture and the cult of the individual and individualism certainly tends us towards narcissism. But I think we have to remember that underneath what that surface is someone who's always suffering. Now, I don't know if that answers your question, Jack, but that's what I'm going to say about it.
Sure, clear
that mess up. Anybody else? Yes.
You know, you say here, in our relationship, we each respond to the inevitable pull of our individual destiny.
Yeah.
Now, that seems to me a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
And my question to you is, how do you have that individual destiny and show some consideration to your partner?
Talk a lot. I mean, that's how you do it. You talk a lot. And you work. I mean, that's the thing that has to happen. You know, when I'm doing marriage therapy, you know what I try to do? You know what I'm doing? I'm not. My operation is sit over to one side and try to make people talk to each other about whatever faces. And then say, let's hope that this conversation that you've had here today continues when you get home. Because these are very, very powerful forces that are going on. People are truly pulled to accomplish things that may or may not help the relationship survive. So you have to talk to one and say, here's what it is I want to do. How can we work this out? Yes?
Like the early part of all the relationships invariably are very, very good. And what I found in middle age was that falling in love again was every bit as good as it was when I was 17. And if you actually follow the human pattern of changing partners every 7 years, then you're always in that state. is your argument for suffering? Why should we expose ourselves to this pathology that keep going back to?
There's no reason to.
I mean, apart from the fact that it benefits the grains, other than it benefits another species.
Yeah.
That's why we suffer.
Yeah.
I think we've gone beyond that as we've gone to a post-agrarian culture.
Right. Well, I'm not saying you shouldn't suffer. We're not promoting it by any stretch.
Get an abortion by a new woman.
Yeah.
Very simple.
Yeah. And then come to hate her and then start over again.
Exactly. And then we can, like,
you know,
it was a built-in thing in our DNA to ensure that each of your progeny has a different spouse involved, which gives you a geometric increase in immunity. And so there's an evolutionary advantage to doing that. That's been our pattern for 99.5% of human history, at least according to hunter-gatherer studies.
Yeah, no, let me remind you that I'm not here to say this is what you should be doing. You know, that you should be going out and getting married and having long, heavy marriages. Because there are a lot of people who shouldn't be doing it. Like, probably you shouldn't be doing it. That's just, some people shouldn't do it. That's all there is to it. It's not for everybody. It's only for those who, you know, are have the makeup and the willingness and the interest for whatever the reason. I think, you know, I've been married for 35 years. And I spent the first half of that trying to get divorced. You know, and something kept pulling me back, you know.
Well, I mean, St. Teresa had all kinds of pleasure from doing really boring things. But, you know, that's part of our Christian heritage is to suffering is good.
I'm not promoting that suffering is good. What I'm saying, suffering comes with the things that we choose to do, that we commit ourselves to. For instance, the Buddhists, you know, who knows suffering better than the Buddhists? What they say is, to exist is to suffer. Suffering and existence are exactly the same thing. Once we acknowledge that and accept that to suffer, to exist is to suffer, then that suffering becomes tolerable, and we even begin to find meaning. Now, does that mean, again, do I promote suffering? Do I promote that you get your hand with a...
I think more along the lines of what the Bantu say of the cup, which they said, they laugh a lot, they can't help it.
Say that again?
The Bantu, the agricultural people, going into the Kalahari Desert hunter-gatherers,
yeah.
What they say about them is, they laugh a lot, they can't help it. And I think that isn't that a better model? I mean, maybe you should be doing more divorce counseling.
You know, about half of what you do in marriage counseling is divorce counseling.
Exactly.
I mean, because here's the truth of it. Look, most people, when they come to marriage counseling, they're kind of like the people that put their dead cat in an ice chest, go up to the vet and say, can you do something with it?
You're wrong to walk on two legs. That doesn't mean he's going to do it well. Right. And it's the same with expecting humans to go into this artificial construct.
Yeah, that's why I say it's a mess.
It's an artificial mess.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. I mean, it's an artificial construct. I mean, marriage is a rule-driven relationship. It's a contract. It's a legal contract. And that the only entity in the world that creates things like that is us, because we have consciousness.
But when you get a new partner, all the magic comes back.
For a while,
So my first marriage, I was married 19 years, and I had high expectations of great happiness, and I did not achieve that. And my second marriage, I have lower expectations, and I'm much happier. So can you speak about this? Maybe it has to do with age or experience, but to not expect this pure bliss, and so you're not disappointed. Can you talk about that a little better? What are your thoughts on that?
It sounds like you accepted that it's a mess, and that she and I are both going to get into this mess together, and we're going to figure out how to be in this mess as partners. Now, sometimes you can do that in your first marriage. Actually, I think I'm married to the same woman for 35 years. I'm probably about my 10th or 12th marriage. because each time there's this horrendous conflict, something about that old relationship burns off, you know, and there's this reemergence of new stuff, new tissue, however you want to think about it, right? So, you know, yeah, you
figured out how to be in the nest with your partner. That's my guess. Okay, here's the thing that I like to share with people, because I can't share it with anybody else. My dog The business of the long-term committed relationship is working out the problems that are caused by the relationship. That's what we do. That's the real business. Coming together in this rule-driven contract creates problems. It creates problems of where to live, how to supply that living, how to put a roof, how to create shelter, how to buy food, how to educate children. Problems, problems, problems. It doesn't solve problems, it only creates problems. And what we do, the actual business of day in and day out life is, let's solve this problem today. This problem of, it can be everything from, you left the lid off the peanut butter last night and your dog got it, to, is our sex life dead? Right? Everything between that and that. And the rock that we continue to push uphill is that piece of business right here. You can run from it, and that's an okay choice. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing right about it either. Or you can stay there and deal with it. What I think happens is, if you stay and deal with it, is that gradually over time, you become a more complex person. More complex person, I think. That's
just. Are you saying you grow up?
Yeah. I say you grow up.
All grow up, you know.
Yeah. Anybody have any comments about that? The business of relationships and solving the problems caused by them.
Well, there are some long-term goals in relationship. I mean, I think the more successful marriages are when people start off looking in the same direction rather than looking at each other. And traditionally, one of the goals of marriage is to raise children and then and have a family that is a punchy family, and this is a great pleasure for you as you get older, and to establish a place in the community, and joint effort on that ground helps a lot too. So there are these long-term goals, and I guess having good sex is a very important one to begin with, but that tends to fade away after a few years, and there are biological and hormonal correlates with that that obviously originated with the hunter-gatherers where the woman needed a man to support her at least for several years while the baby was weaned and so on. So we're dealing with an inheritance of, which is a mess, actually, and it was involved to help people, help individual communities survive in small groups in a hostile environment with a high death rate, and now we're in a very different situation, and I guess the problem is now to work around that. But I do think the long-term goals in a marriage is something that an essential feature to begin with, and maybe it's just surviving and being successful in life and not having conflicts with the person who's attracted to.
Yeah, one of the biggest problems that people confront in these relationships is when kids leave home. You know, then it's like, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know, because you realize that all of this energy that has been involved in getting kids raised and educated and out the door and all of that energy, you know, it's like when the other side stops pulling on the rope, you know, you just... So, and I think that is a very big, and it's an existential problem. It's just like, how do we give meaning to our lives together now? How do we devote ourselves to what's going on right now, to what seems so empty with kids gone? It seems so empty now. How do we infuse this emptiness with meaning?
Right. Part of it as you get older is to build up relationships with your children's spouses and grandchildren
And because of a community of like-minded people, we're going to share this exact point that the philosophers want.
Right. So could you, your talk is sort of focused on the relationship as if the man and the woman were equal. And in our society and many other societies, there's really a big power difference. And it's a lot easier for a man to leave a relationship often than for a woman, traditionally, because the way we structure relationships. We don't have to do it that way, but that's historically how it's evolved. So it seems to me that there needs to be some comment about that power difference and how to manage it the way that you focus on how to solve these problems. Or maybe not, but I thought I would raise the issue for you to deal with if you chose to.
I don't want to.
Okay. Okay, another question.
But I wonder if you could expand on that. I mean, we could just get some more to say about it.
No, about I just think it's, I can remember, it's not as true now as it was, let's say, 25 or 30 years ago, because many more women have careers now. But certainly 25 years ago was much less common. And so for a woman, her livelihood depended on trying to maintain the relationship in ways that for the man, it really didn't matter. Yeah. So that it would, for a man to change relationships every 7 years, was maybe not such a big deal. But for a woman, it was a very big deal. And while it's changed to some extent, and women are much more independent now than they were 25 years ago, we still have a society in which there's substantial sexist structures that exist. And so it still is harder, I think, for a woman to leave a relationship than for a man to leave a relationship. And there are physical differences as well, which is why we have shelters for abused women, but very few shelters for abused men. And so so it seems to me that in dealing with marital interaction, something needs to be said about that power difference. But you really, the way you've described the situation is as if they are equals.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me that there's a sense in which they're not really equals.
Okay.
Yeah. And in this world today, I mean, women are soon to be the majority of the workforce, and they certainly have had good jobs as men do these days. And myself, I have 3 exes, and all of them make more money than I do. I think you are very, that whole attitude is not considered politically correct in a post-feminist world. I think that's no longer recognized.
I'm not sure that's correct. Yeah. I think that they may not be. It may not be popular, but we often don't like to admit who we are and what we are.
Well, right now, professional schools are graduating majority women. Universities are graduating majority women. They're both very interesting as far as the ability to make a living right now. So I don't think that women would think of themselves as being inferior as to apply.
Women are telling guys to get out all the time.
Right.
You're finally the boss more often than men.
And also,
women are filing for divorce at least twice as often as men. And the other thing I would say is that men who win arguments with women are out of the gene pool. No sex for men. This is not only true for human societies, it's true for animal societies as well. No sex for men who win arguments.
Wait a minute. Go ahead.
Well, you're talking about like dual long-term relationships to find an existential sense of meaning in life. I think that I wish you would also address that those of us who live most of our lives outside, the long committed relationship, who have found, that life in itself has essential meaning and have for decades.
Yeah, okay. I certainly didn't want to make it sound like I'm here to tell you that the only way to find meaning in life is by being in a long-term committed relationship. It is probably one of the most common ways.
And most, have you ever been in a long-term relationship? Ever?
Times. Huh? Variously.
Variously. Okay. So, at times you have been in a long-term committed relationship. Yes.
The discussion is centered on concepts that are sociological, anthropological, and to some extent, I suppose, even political. I'm curious about your take, though, on the notion of love. I'm a little surprised that we haven't really talked a whole lot about love.
Yeah.
And from the standpoint of the experiential therapist or phenomenological physician, particularly with your background from Duquesne, Adrian Montcalm, and the whole gang of this, how did you think about love as a human experience and the attraction that we have to another person? And comparing and contrasting perhaps that kind of attraction to our attraction to anything that we love or care about.
You know, at the end of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections by Carl Jung, his autobiography, I don't know if anybody's ever read it or not, but he did take on the problem of love. And there he says that love is the most complex, confounding, and most difficult problem he encountered in his career. And he said he only knows, and I'm going back to memories, but the only thing he could say about it is to allow yourself to succumb to it.
Sorry, what?
To allow yourself to succumb to it. That was about as far as he could go. But, you know, love begins as, in this context, begins as a profoundly physical experience, a profoundly, completely all-encompassing physical experience that then changes over time. So that over time, what you learn how to do is that love then becomes the business of staying in the business of solving these problems together. I don't want to. It's beyond my capacities here tonight to comment intelligently about love. I want to talk more about what the day in and day out business of it. You're asking a very good question, and it requires more expansiveness than I've got with me. Yeah.
Have you spent much time investigating relationships that are relatively smooth, that is, they don't get so far as to need to come to a counselor? You know, I mean, I know none of them are perfect.
Yeah.
But some of them are relatively smooth. And as a subcategory of that, most Westerners are repugnant to the idea of arranged marriage. But when you look at the happiness level, you don't find the great discrepancy between arranged marriages and Western dating that we would expect.
Never studied arranged marriages, so I don't know a lot about that. What I think I know about arranged marriages is one of the things that it's assumed is you get to keep on being the person you always were if you're a man. But if you're a woman, you know, the handcuffs are on you in arranged marriages. That's what I think I know. I want to keep on up. There's a couple more of these comments that I want to make, and then we'll have to conclude. One of the things that people believe early in life is, early in the long-term committed relationship is that you and I, we're going to work real hard together, and we're going to solve all of our problems, and then we're going to be happy. What I have come to understand is that the problems that confront us in our relationships are the glue of the relationship. Without problems, the relationship falls apart. Without problems to solve, without things to, without tasks to attend to, the relationships become empty, joyless, meaningless. People start running around on one another because that's where the problems are. You know, how to sneak around without getting caught. How to have sex with that person in the hotel room without being covering your tracks. See, that's all kind of, you know, that's all kind of buzz and excitement and problems to solve. When there's no problems here for us to solve, it ends. So, as long as there's problems to solve, then you have a relationship that is workable and functional. And people that, get ready to speak for something, but the problems are the glue of the relationship. Relationship, to me, do not begin until problems happen. Early on, when everything is great, biochemically driven, so forth and so on, then it's a dance of bodies. It is instinctual. It is biochemical. It is written into our genes. It's only when problems, like, why did you look at me that way? Or don't use that tone of voice on me. Or don't give me that look. Or why did you say that? That's when this collision is starting. And that's when the relationship is beginning, and that's when intimacy is beginning. Prior to that, it has been something else. It has been an engagement of, I guess you could say, an engagement of egos.
Wouldn't it depend more on solving the problems, getting over them? I mean, if the problems arise that you don't solve them, having the problems isn't much better.
I'm going to tell you, my wife and I have been having the same fights 35 years. I mean, it's some form of the same fight over and over. And I think that if you really think back, if you've been in a really long-term relationship, you'll notice that every relationship has its individual, its stamp of individuality that is characterized by the same struggles again and again and again. In other words, the two of us together, we're working as hard as we possibly can to solve an unsolvable problem. And that doesn't mean that since we can't solve that problem, we shouldn't be together. It just means that that is part of our glue. It's part of how we work together. It's part of what it's the thing that we do. Anybody got any goal or, you know, any experiential? Yeah.
This is great. I really like what you just said. I have told people for years that in our marriage we have what we call the oven problem. And it comes from the first couple. We've been married 35 years. And I would tell folks, well, I see what you're talking about. This is what my wife might call the oven problem. And I said this over several years, and then about 6 months ago, someone said, well, that's interesting, what's the oven problem? And I honest to God could not remember. I just remember there was this phenomenon that happened 34 years ago without an oven in a kitchen somewhere, and that, you know, we had that same fight over and over again for 35 years.
Yeah.
But I honest to God could not tell you what happened.
Yeah. Somebody over here said that's age.
Yeah, ask me in 10 years, I'll remember it.
Well, I can offer an anecdote. My youngest sister had her gold wedding earlier this year. And I talked to her and my brother-in-law, and I said, you know, but there were all these wonderful things said at the reception, and someone said, have you ever had any arguments? And both of them said, no, we never had any arguments. So I don't know what sort of problems they were facing or not solving or something.
They were having the problem of not having arguments. And that's a real problem. That's a terrible problem, because that means that, you know, that here's the people that avoid conflict, all they ever get is conflict. Most of it is unspoken and inside themselves.
Well, I never saw any of that.
Yeah. Okay, we're at 8:30, Mark. You know what? There's more that I haven't covered on the sheet, on the handout. But, you know, I'm going to stop anyway. My My email address is on there if you want to send me an email and ask questions about anything we talked about or anything that we didn't talk about or anything that's towards the end here. Feel free. I'd be happy to return your email. Thank you for being a great audience. I've had a good time.
Thank you.